You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Monday, October 1st, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, director, producer, Eugene Jaracki. On his new documentary, The House I Live In, opening in theaters at the end of this week. Amazing film about the drug war. Meanwhile, we're only 2 days away from the first of the three presidential debates. There will be one vice presidential debate. Wednesday will be a domestic debate. I don't think we're going to do a live coverage of this one. I think we're going to wait for the town hall. But be prepared. Apparently, Mitt Romney has been studying zingers. More on that as the show continues. Also, more importantly even, if you can believe it, than Mitt Romney studying zingers, Paul Krugman, fortunately, happily, now on the grand bargain. What are we calling this? What have I been on for months? I've been warning about the grand bargain. There's other people, but it's nice to see someone do it in the New York Times. Interesting dichotomy between President Obama and Mitt Romney on torture. Maybe we'll hear some of that in weeks to come. Some good news for California. We'll get to that in just a moment. And perhaps even New York as well. Nothing massive, but it's pretty good. Meanwhile, Paul Ryan, the man with the math, apparently needs a calculator to tell that story. All right, so briefly, I know a lot of you aren't in New York, but you certainly have followed this. And many times as New York goes, the rest of the country goes. So this is somewhat encouraging. And just also goes to show you the power of activists. I think we've had everybody from Mark Ruffalo on this program. We've had Josh Fox on this program. We've had more policy-oriented people on this program. But according to the New York Times, a few months after Governor Andrew Cuomo was poised to approve hydraulic fracturing in several struggling New York counties, his administration is reversing course and starting the regulatory process over. 10 days ago, after nearly 4 years of review by state regulators, the governor bowed to entreaties from environmentalists to conduct another study. This one, an examination of potential impacts on public health. As if you really need to look into public health when you're deciding to put all sorts of unnamed poisons into the ground where our water is. Then on Friday... this is the last week, state environmental officials said they would restart the regulatory rulemaking process, requiring them to repeat a number of formal steps, including holding a public hearing and almost certainly pushing a decision into next year. This is not over, ladies and gentlemen, but it is encouraging. In this instance, the more you delay these things, the better chance it has of not happening. So kudos to all the activists out there. Bobby Kennedy's quoted in this quite a bit in this New York Times piece. But just wanted to, don't know. It's a feel-good story of the day. There's another one that we will talk about later in the program out of California, and I will give you one hint about what that is. Oh, I don't think I have it. No, I do.
Mom! 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 Why did you do that to me?
Longtime listeners will know what that's reference to, and we'll talk about what's happening in California as to why that sound of a man hitting a tennis racket onto a couch will only be heard by adults and not teenagers, fortunately, in California. All right, folks, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Eugene Jaracki. And now what we're going to do is play a clip or a the trailer from his new documentary, The House I Live In, opening in theaters October 5th. We'll be back in just a moment.
You have to understand the war on drugs has never been about drugs.
America's public enemy number one is drug abuse.
What will you do when someone offers you drugs?
We intend to end the drug menace and to eliminate this dark, evil enemy within.
Put them away. Put them away where they
belong.
Three
strikes and you are out.
Somebody down the road said drugs are bad. Okay, there's no argument there. But think about where we are 30 years later.
I do what I have to do. I know how to survive.
Yeah, I got some weed, too.
Don't let her run.
The war against drugs is heating up.
I think they should have wrote prison guard on my forehead when I was born because it just fits me.
I say he's a criminal. Let him go to prison.
I have a life and 30-year sentence.
20 years for drug trafficking.
I have life without parole for 3 ounces of methamphetamine.
Of the 2,600 people I've sent to federal prison, I've seen 3 or 4 kingpins. We're incarcerating poor people who are drug addicts.
You're watching poor, uneducated people be fed into a machine like meat to make sausage.
Law enforcement agencies get rewarded in cash for the sheer numbers of drug arrests.
That money's ours now. That's my money now.
The scale is unbelievable.
Nobody jails their population at the rate that we do.
All sorts of people get a financial interest.
Taser gun manufacturers, healthcare providers, phone companies.
You build a bed, they fill the bed. And you'll get rich, and we'll get rich, and we'll all be rich together.
Engage in a great experiment. What happens when you take large numbers of people, remove them from their neighborhoods, their families?
What y'all getting them for?
What does this do to the broader community?
The drug war is a Holocaust in slow motion.
This is a war on all Americans. I think people keep saying, well, that's about them. Well, no, it's about you.
Yeah.
All right, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program documentary filmmaker of Why We Fight and the trials of Henry Kissinger, the Freakonomics, and most recently, The House I Live In. Welcome to the program, Eugene Jarecki.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Let me just start by saying I really loved your film, and I thought it was incredibly, and you know, I'm aware of this this stuff, and I found it both incredibly informative and very moving. So I want to just start off by congratulating you on the film.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. I hope other people think that too.
I mean, I imagine they will. And I want to go through some of the generally speaking, the film. I want to encourage people, obviously, to see this. And I want to start sort of at the end and work backwards. But let me actually just start off at the beginning. You started with you made a very interesting choice, and I have to say it's also, you know, I think some people might consider it somewhat controversial. I don't particularly, but that you start with telling the story of your parents or your grandparents who escaped the Holocaust, or at least one parent did from the Nazis and one, I think, from Europe. And you tie this in as if it was your inspiration for this film. Just tell us about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, like a lot of Jewish Americans, I mean, I grew up the child of people who were themselves children of flight. You know, my father fled Nazi Germany in 1939. My mother's family fled the Tsars of Russia earlier in the 20th century. And so the kids in my family, we were all taught from, you know, the time we were in knee pants that, you know, we were supposed to devote our lives to the struggle for social justice wherever we saw it. And in the American story, of course, that focused most centrally on the struggle for civil rights for African Americans, for women, for other groups. And so I had a sensitivity from the time I was a child that was, you know, it was in the drinking water. To look out for groups that were on the receiving end of injustice one way or another. And Black Americans were the focus of that. And so ultimately, as I saw Black Americans absorb indignities in the wake of the civil rights movement at a time where I thought we would see tremendous racial progress, tremendous social, economic, political progress, I saw instead that over the recent decades, the leading indicators for Black America, notwithstanding having a Black president and some Black celebrities have achieved a great deal, for the masses of Black people, the indicators are grim. And I tried to understand what was at the heart of that, i.e., what was blocking Black progress. And more, it became clear that it was the war on drugs.
And so, I mean, but by the end of the film, on some level, at least the notion of, I mean, what you've just described, at least in terms of an impetus, could really describe why you became a documentary filmmaker in many respects, particularly the films that you, or many of the films that you've done. Was this something that came to you before him? Because by the end of the film, there is a, at least some measure of a comparison in the sense that society, either by simply by its own momentum, is taking a group of people, and essentially dispensing with them in some fashion. It ties back in both as a, I guess, an impetus, but also in terms of a dynamic.
Yeah, well, in that sense, this film is unique in my career. I mean, there's no question my entire adult life has been devoted to pursuing social justice through making films about areas of concern. And in general, I tend, and it's the nature of my movies, I tend not to vilify individual human beings, even if I'm making a film about whether Henry Kissinger should be, you know, looked at as a potential war crime suspect. I'm actually not out to get Henry Kissinger. I'm out to get the system that hires, promotes, and elevates people like Henry Kissinger to do those things that, frankly, we as a public tacitly ask them to do. So I'm interested in the systemic failures that surround us to be the democracy we seek to be. I think many of us in our hearts are peace-seeking people who want democracy, and yet we live in a system that obstructs democracy, has allowed the richest Americans, 400 of them, to have more money than 150 million, a statistic that undermines any notion that you can have equality of voice, equality of influence, et cetera. So I tend to want to put systems of abuse on trial, and we are unfortunately increasingly surrounded by them in the modern era. This is the first film where I've actually been able to take my past, the roots of a social justice persona as I have, and put them sort of in the same sentence, in the same paragraph, in the same context with something I'm studying in the present day, i.e. the war on drugs. And so the analogy does not need to be overdrawn. Anyone with a sensitivity to the persecution of voiceless people from anywhere you've come from in the world should be concerned about the persecution of voiceless people here at home, whether they're poor black people, whether they're poor white people. The drug war is increasingly democratizing to simply target poor people in general. But, of course, it began in the modern era with the targeting of black Americans to the tune that we are the world's largest incarcerator with 2.3 million people behind bars. About half of those are for nonviolent drug offenses, and, of course, the majority of those arrested and convicted and jailed are black, even though they represent a small portion of American society. So those statistics tell a story about the abuse, the persecution of a group in society, and we've seen chapter by chapter in American history and world history that groups do get singled out for vilification, and then it becomes a kind of almost inevitable chain of events that leads ultimately to tremendous destruction. It doesn't have to lead to death and systemic annihilation as it did to the Jews of Europe, but it does often lead to what we've seen with Black America, which is the wholesale, widespread orphaning, disintegration, and forced decaying of a major section of the sons and daughters of an American population.
In fact, the chain of destruction is a concept discussed by one of the historians in your piece, yeah. Outlining, I guess, five steps, which are part of this momentum of society when they want to sort of, I don't know, get rid of a population. But it seems to me the argument of your film is that this is the way that we have dispensed with either immigrant populations or, some subset of our population at one time or another that has migrated from the Chinese through to other immigrant populations, to African-Americans as seen as immigrants from rural into urban areas, and now on to just simply poor people, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, the historian you're referring to is Richter Lawrence Miller, who was doing something interesting. He applied the work of Raoul Hilberg, the Holocaust scholar, to the American situation and said, what if you were to look at what's happening in America, you would raise, you saw what was happening in the Balkans, in Rwanda, in foreign countries, in the shadow, of course, of what happened in Nazi Germany. And the point is not to create quantitative analysis of which crisis is worse than any other. Of course, what's unique to the Holocaust should be left unique to the Holocaust. But what he did point out is that you do see a pattern, and this was Raoul Hilberg's analysis of cost, and it stands for, and Hilberg himself believed it stood for, many conflicts. What you see is a chain of events where it has five steps. It begins with identification, in which a group is singled out as a source of society's woes. That group is then isolated. That's kind of the next step, where physically in ghettos or in parts of town that are cordoned off in a way by social practices, suddenly the people are isolated away from the general population. The third step is where law enforcement becomes involved and begins to confiscate those persons' property and persons and their rights to persons and property. So suddenly, as with Nuremberg laws or even with America's, with New York's stop and frisk laws, suddenly it's possible to stop and detain and harass a person who formerly had more established civil rights than that. All of a sudden, those rights get weakened and softened and abridged. And so there becomes this problem of, now the third step is where law enforcement now starts to weaken the civil liberties of those involved. That leads to the fourth step, of course, which is concentration. Well, what do you do with these persons and property that you've confiscated? Well, you need to concentrate them somewhere. And so you end up with prisons, camps, labor areas. This happens in society after society. The fifth step is, of course, what happened in the Holocaust and what happened in other societies where you have really systematic annihilation going on, Cambodia and elsewhere. That, thankfully, is not happening in America. And yet what's terrifying, however, is that the first four are happening to a grotesque degree to black Americans and now more broadly to poor Americans. And so for me, enough is enough. Four out of five ain't bad. I want to stop at four and say, how far is this drug war going to go before those of us who have a social responsibility to look out for those around us in a democratic society, say enough is enough.
You know, what struck me is that, and of course, we're not at that fifth point. And I don't know within the context of our society that we will. And I think part of that was touched on about by David Simon, who makes who is prominent in your film. He was a former crime reporter and obviously has spent was the writer of The Wire, which you know was as delved deeply into these issues as anything. And I saw another quote from him. I'm not quite frankly sure where it was. Someone had presented it to me, part of another project, but where he talked about and he alluded to this just how profitable these first four stages are for certain segments of our society. And at one point you go to, you know, a convention where they're selling all sorts of products that one would need to do these things, particularly on the concentration level. And it's this in some way is sort of the capitalist version of this. We want to sustain this population to there's just a tremendous amount of financial incentive to do so.
Yes. I mean, that's, you know, one of the things I learned most starkly in the process of traveling around this country, I went to about 25 states to examine the drug war at all levels of the people who are involved in it, those on the receiving end of the laws, i.e. drug dealers, family members, victims in one way or another, or also those who are meting out the punishment, the law enforcement people, the jailers, the wardens, the judges, the prosecutors. Everyone I spoke to a person, what they began to paint was a system of, you know, what, again, Hilberg would call bureaucratic thrust. In other words, that this monster has taken on a life of its own. Once upon a time, a politician, it was Richard Nixon in this case, started to talk tough on crime. And what happened from that moment, despite the fact that Nixon himself was not so tough on crime, he actually was quite sympathetic to the notion that treatment should be the dominant part of a nation's approach to drug addiction. In words, he talked tough on crime, and it worked electorally. And ever since then, politician after politician knows that if you know anything in this country, you know that being anything other than tough on crime is supposedly political suicide. Whether I agree with that or not is another matter, but we drank that Kool-Aid decades ago, and everybody's been living off of it ever since. And living off of it they have, because it is politically profitable, and then it is also economically profitable to those corporations in this country that rely deeply upon the steady flow of human beings that draconian drug laws produce. So what happens is you now have industries in this country, everything from the food service to the laundry service to who keeps the lights on to the private prison industry and everyone in between, from stun gun makers to restraint chair makers, it goes on and on, where I start to understand why a system so broken, a system on which we have spent $1 trillion in 40 years, we have had 45 million drug arrests, and we have failed on every level to curb the supply and demand of drugs. We now have cheaper drugs, more available, more in use today than ever before. So the story of failure is so grotesque that you have to ask yourself, well, what's keeping this thing going? And the answer to what's keeping it going is the bureaucratic thrust of all of those concentrated interests aggregated together as a kind of constituent against change. And so that's what really becomes, and you mentioned the police, sure. Police are incentivized to do minor drug arrests. Police get goodies for that. Whole police departments run, I learned, on the stuff they confiscate from people. So the vehicles they confiscate get auctioned, and the money runs the police department. The money that they capture in the midst of drug transactions that are seized by the police, those monies become I sat in a patrol car and had a sheriff tell me that the car I was sitting in had been paid for by the gains he made in a drug arrest. And he told me this with an absolutely straight face, and he's one of many. It's standard rule in policing that most Americans don't know. And so all of this runaway corruption that's emerged is the inevitable result of a system that has misguided priorities, that puts profit before principle on the highest levels. And so, of course, that's one place where trickle-down actually does work. Corruption does trickle down. If Rumsfeld says at his desk, hey, I wonder what it would be like to torture people, it doesn't take long till a week later they're torturing people in the field. And, of course, he didn't really give the order. It was just a spirit. Well, that spirit of corruption on high in this country, where bankers steal from the public and get off, where legitimized corruption is the norm, well, that trickles down. And so you find it at the everyman level. A person who really is just trying to do their job well suddenly finds themselves trapped in a cycle of corruption.
Do you think, I mean, I was struck when, you know, there's so many different facets of this, and your film really does a great job in encompassing the different perspectives on this phenomena. And one part that really stuck out to me, and you mentioned it just briefly in this last, was the way that police are incentivized to get small busts. And David Simon speaks about how this is corrupting sort of police work. And because it incentivizes the sort of the easy arrest that you can make on the street that, you know, maybe stop and frisk might promote, as opposed to going out and doing really long police work on one. And that dynamic also struck me is what we see with the corporate reform of education in some way, that there needs to be some easy metric in which these people can be judged and rewarded that doesn't necessarily really serve the function that they're supposed to be serving. In other words,
what I would say about that, first of all, you know, David Simon being in a film is really a gift to me and to anybody who gets to see the film. I think David Simon is a national treasure. I think he's contributed incredibly to Americans' understanding of how the other half is being destroyed. And I think that what he contributes on this score in the film is crucial to understand. What he taught me is that police, of course, have learned over time that the most profitable way to be a cop, the best way to get yourself ahead, make a living and keep a good living and so forth, is to rack up as many easy, cheap drug arrests in the course of a night as you can, because you can sit in your radio car and just jack people up repeatedly against the side of a liquor store. And for each of those, you get an overtime slip. You get all kinds of filings inside the system to show what an active police officer you are. And it's, you know, it's low hanging fruit, easy pickings, et cetera. And so let's call that Officer A, who's sitting in his patrol car racking up 50 or 60 arrests a month. Now you get Officer B, who's sort of in that old school. He became a cop because he wanted to solve those crimes we're all really concerned about, like rape, robbery, murder. And so he thinks to himself, you know what, that murder over on 3rd Street, I wonder if that's related to that rape that happened over on 4th Street. I'm going to work that. I got a hunch here. I'm going to work that the way I was taught cops are supposed to work things. Well, if he's lucky, he might solve one case a month, if he's lucky. So when it comes to the end of the month and he's solved one important case, and that's Officer B, and Officer A has solved 50 or 60 irrelevancies, well, on paper, they just look like Officer A got 50 or 60 arrests. Officer B got one arrest. So as David Simon said with a very tragic look in his eye, who do you think they make the sergeant? And so we are promoting an entire class of people in this country who, by no fault of their own, have been sort of caught up and trapped in this cheap and easy quick fix cycle of law enforcement that trickles down from our inappropriately draconian drug laws. Because at the end of the day, the way that policing has been disfigured is not the fault of the police. It's the fault of the system. And it's the fault of those of us who have turned a blind eye while this system targeted in a predatory way defenseless and poor populations in this country over time. Of course, in the modern era, mostly it's been black Americans, but in the more recent past, it's now becoming increasingly whoever is poor in America. And of course, with the economy as it is, whoever's poor is starting to look much more colorful. You've got black people, you've got white people, you've got Latino, you have every shade of person in this country who's hemorrhaging under this economy now finds that they're in pain, they need to self-medicate, they can't get a job, they might have a strike on their record, which makes it impossible to get a job. So now what industry will have them? Well, only an underground economy will have them. And they've got a little addiction going. So they've got to service the addiction, and so the cycle continues.
You know, I found what I found fascinating, too, was that this modern, I guess, version of the drug war was, as you mentioned, Nixon's politics almost gone awry. And but it started out as specifically as a tool to target specific groups. Just touch on that for a moment, because that was one of the most sort of enlightening aspects.
That was a fascinating thing. I mean, sure, I mean, the modern history of the drug war begins with Richard Nixon, but that's not the history of drug laws in America. Before it was a war, we had drug laws going back in this country to the 1800s. The first drug laws we saw targeted Chinese immigrant groups, particularly in California, who were seen as a threat to American jobs, whether they were or not. They were seen as a threat to American women. And basically, the Chinese got targeted with opium laws. We said, look, we can't put these people away just because they're Chinese. We need a good pretext. Well, let's find something that Chinese people especially do and put them away for that. Well, it turned out that the number one user, the problem was the number one user of opium in the mid-1800s in America were not Chinese people. It was middle-aged white women. So what we did was found a specific way that the Chinese were using opium, because they smoked opium, whereas Americans, Caucasian Americans, were not smoking opium. They were using it in other ways. So in California, and only in California, where the Chinese were concentrated, we made smoking opium and only smoking opium illegal. So very selective law enforcement meant to do nothing other than target and harass a specific ethnic group, and that continued chapter by chapter. The next group we saw targeted were Reconstruction Black Americans, who were, having now been freed from slavery, were now seen as a potential threat to jobs. And so, of course, around the turn of the 20th century, we see that blacks are suddenly associated with cocaine. You see headlines that say crazed Negroes terrorizing a town, or, you know, cocaine-fiend Negroes are going to terrorize your women or take your job, etc. And so now we see the identification of black Americans at that time with cocaine as a threat, and laws were passed at that time that could help harass and target that population. And then the next chapter was Mexican-Americans with the Mexicanization of hemp. We now call it marijuana. That's why we do so. And that was to be able to be called, to call it the Mexican opium that we started to call it at that time. And so we've seen this chapter by chapter. And, of course, the most modern example is what we did with crack in the 80s, where crack became identified with the black community. And we passed the most severe drug laws in American history to deal with that moment. And we're now turning our attention to meth, with the focusing not on a racial population, but on a population defined by class, poor whites.
And we should say, we can't put too fine a point on the sentencing disparities and the sort of the legal disparities between what happens if you get caught with crack versus cocaine. Some of that's been rolled back under the Obama administration. Still, like 20-1, 18-1.
Sure. Yeah, for the past 30 years, it's been the case that crack is punished 100 times more severely than powder. If I'm walking down the street with 5 grams of crack, and you are walking down the street with powder or cocaine, you need to have 500 grams of powder to get the same sentence as my 5 little grams of crack. And by the way, your 500 grams of powder is a major federal crime. It's a major amount of money. It has a huge street value. My little 5 grams of crack are a pittance by comparison. They are the same drug, chemically the same drug. Crack, if anything, is sort of a weakened form of powder. It has baking soda and water added to it. So chemically speaking, we're dealing with the same substance, and yet they are getting a sentence that's 100 times worse for crack. And so that was so grotesque over the years and so silly that experts appeared before Congress countless times over and over to say, this is not based in medical science. It makes no sense in law enforcement. And, of course, the net result of it is it's having an incredibly destructive impact on the black community. And Congress dug in its heels and did nothing for 30 years until just this past year, in an action that when audiences in my movie hear about it, they laugh out loud. The U.S. government has now lowered it from 100 to 1 to 18 to 1.
Right.
So why it didn't go to 1 to 1 mystifies experts, but we still seem to be clinging to the need to punish crack far more severely than powder. And an 18 to 1 sentence is a terrible blow to anybody who gets it, and continues the unequal justice before the law that has plagued the drug war for the past 30, 40 years.
I thought one of the things that was really a revelation to me was the implications of Nixon, while his policies were more oriented towards treatment. His rhetoric was all about criminality, and it makes sense on some level, because this was he was trying to play on the fears, I think, of sort of the supposed silent majority and all the transition and change that was happening in this country. But the implications of that rhetoric, we're still basically dealing with the implications of that rhetoric, aren't we?
We are. I mean, Nixon is to be commended for having had a very smart approach to the drug problem in America. Two-thirds of his budget was spent on treatment, only one-third on law enforcement. I think a sensible approach would have to be even further toward treatment, but that's a huge leap from where we are today, where the vast majority, over 90%, is spent on law enforcement and a tiny pittance on treatment. And so Nixon, in fact and in practice, had quite progressive and quite excellent approaches to the drug problem. But he had learned in 68 that when he ran on a tough-on-crime national platform, it did him very well, because it turns neighbor against neighbor, and you create those sort of vilifying, frenzied public emotions that help politicians get elected. And so he got elected that way in 68, and he knew when 72 came around that he should go back on the campaign trail and talk tough about crime, and he did so with landslide results. And so the die was cast. For decades now, we've watched politician after politician try to out-Nixon Nixon on this flank, ignoring completely what he actually did in office. They made it real. They've walked that walk.
It's so fascinating to me. I mean, this is a little bit tangential, but first off, we know how this dovetails in with the Southern strategy, and it's no coincidence that this is, you know, all following 1965, and things like Willie Horton have played a part in our presidential politics. But it also speaks to a huge argument that I often have with political scientists on the sort of the sheer impact of rhetoric, and how. One, you know, you can credit Nixon with having a good policy at that time. So maybe he had a decent policy for 4 or 6 years or whatever it was. But he's created a legacy of 30 years of just utterly destructive policy.
Yeah, I mean, all true. And yet at the same time, I want to be very clear that one of the things you learn when you travel around this country is that the drug war and its trespasses and its horrendous tale of destruction is not owned by one party or the other.
Right. No. I'm making an argument about rhetoric.
It is. Yeah. I know. But you can watch. You know, you can watch Clinton ratchet up Nixon's rhetoric until we get the three strikes epidemic that gripped this country. You can watch Reagan ratchet up the rhetoric and add to it that special homespun dose of cluelessness mm-hmm. that the Reagans contributed with their. Life in denial concept of just say no. That is such a laughable concept under scientific analysis of any notion of addiction that the fact that it was basically national policy for 8 years and 8 crucial years during the arrival of crack and other epidemics in the drug scene. You have owned by both parties a tale of Nixon emulation and some pretty good innovation themselves on the part of both parties. I mean, Tip O'Neill, who mm-hmm. seized on the death of basketball star Len Bias and helped spin the mythology that Len Bias had died of a crack overdose, which he hadn't, and yet try telling that to Americans today, who, if they know anything about Len Bias, they think he's the poster child of the dangers of crack, when in fact he had never had any crack in his system, wasn't a crack user, and yet those kind of images were so well spun in the 1980s and 90s by Reagan and then Clinton and others, and on both sides of the aisle, that, you know, we have been in a rhetorical field day ever since, because it's almost as if Nixon discovered a special kind of Kool-Aid when he did his right. tough on crime dance that has just gripped our politics ever since. And I do think it's starting to weaken. And I think that because the drug war is such a catastrophe, with $1 trillion spent, 45 million arrests in 40 years and nothing to show for it. Drugs are cheaper, more available than ever before. That reality is so glaring. And we, the democracy that most prides itself on being a beacon to the world, have now become the world's largest jailer, outpacing our totalitarian adversaries in the world, that all of that is so humiliating that you actually find the likes of Pat Robertson and Chris Christie and George Shultz and James Baker and others saying, for our side of the aisle, this thing doesn't work. And they now join the likes of Al Sharpton and Russell Simmons and, right. and celebrities across the spectrum who have been saying for a very long time, this drug war is broken for our reasons. And so I think the drug war's days are numbered in its current form. And the question is, how do we who want meaningful reform inspire the public to begin to demand a far more compassion-based and, frankly, far more educated and informed way of dealing with drug abuse, which, frankly, I mean, 35 million Americans last year admitted that they used drugs. We're dealing with a national phenomenon. And so to be addressing it by targeting defenseless people and basically scapegoating them and putting them away and ruining their lives, to make that the national policy of a leading democracy is shameful. And I think that's becoming ever more clear, and it's becoming clear that it's an economic disaster.
And I believe the house I live in will help in that, and people can check it out at thehouseilivein.org with screening times. And if you'll indulge me, I one final question, and it's more of one slightly as a filmmaker. The story opens up, basically sort of pivots around a relationship that you had with a woman who was sort of, I guess, your housekeeper or your and it's a fascinating relationship that you have with this woman, and you come to realize that her family in some way was decimated, at least in her mind, because she chose to follow your family when your family moved from New Haven, I guess, to somewhere in, the more metro New York. Just talk about that briefly, because, you know, that to me could have been, it's just interesting to me because I that could have been another documentary.
Right.
I mean, it literally could have been.
Sure, the woman's name is Nanny Jedder. She wasn't a nanny. That's actually her name, Nanny, her birth name. She is a person very important to me who I've known since I was born, and was a housekeeper for my family, which was a somewhat large family, and she was in charge of a pretty big household. And, you know, I was kind of always told, you know, never to bother her, but to just sort of pull at her hem all the time, which is what I did, and got on her nerves. But as I got older, we got to really understand and love each other. And I learned much more about her story, and to hear her story is to hear the story of so many Black American families who migrated north because of the promise of the North, and then found that the North had its own bitter pills to swallow, and that at the end of the day, the North, in many ways, chewed up and spat out a lot of the sort of aspiring Southern Blacks who came here. And Nanny Jedder found herself working for my family and needing to make the money that went along with that, and ultimately migrated with my family to New York, leaving her own family in Connecticut. So she became a commuter, leaving her children somewhat unguarded all week while she took care of me. And so there was no question, as I grew up and saw that my life turned out to be one of possibilities and comfort and confidence, her children went quite another way. And they were my playmates growing up. I watched several of them really end up with extremely challenged lives where I did not. And that was certainly in part, not wholly, but in part the inspiration to make a movie more broadly about, you know, if that's how Nanny's family went, how did other American families fare under whatever this scourge was that was hurting Black American families? And as I got closer to it and heard more about both the ravaging of her family by drugs, but worse, the ravaging of her family then by the laws we've put in place to horrendously punish those who become involved with drugs, I started to learn that her story was more the rule than the exception. And I've talked to Black families all over this country about the way in which whatever drugs, as David Simon says so eloquently in the film, you know, what drugs didn't destroy the war against them did, and it just raised the bar on human suffering, on degradation, and on social decay and disenfranchisement to a level drugs could never have dreamt of.
And I think it's all part of the piece that shows that the drug war on some level or another, whether we're conscious of it or not, it touches all of our lives in some dehumanizing way. Obviously not to the extent that it does those people who are caught up in it directly, but it's very powerful stuff, fascinating film, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about it.
Thank you so much. I do want to say the movie comes out this Friday in New York at the Angelica and also at Lincoln Plaza, and it's extremely important for New York listeners interested in this subject to come to the screenings. A movie's entire life is defined by its opening weekend, and therefore when people do come on the opening weekend, first of all, I'm going to be at most of the screening time, so there'll be Q&A at a lot of them, which means people can sort of share their thoughts and views and have a discussion about it. But it's also very important that this issue capture the national imagination at a time where, of course, our candidates want to talk about it like they want a hole in the head. So
right.
We want to make it front and center, and I hope people can come and join us at these screenings.
And it'll be out in the L.A. area on the
It'll come
12th.
Out in L.A. a week later. So it's October 12th. It comes out in Los Angeles wide.
All right, folks. We'll put more information at majority.fm. I can't recommend this movie enough. And I appreciate your coming on, Eugene Jaracki.
Thank you, Sam, very much.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. That is the better half of our – or the lesser half of our program. Oh, my gosh. It's unbelievable how good that lesser half was. We're going to take a break and head into the better half of the program there. It's a great film. And honestly, I mean, I may just go buy a ticket, frankly, just to support it. And it's interesting, you know, I didn't get into this with him just because we had him a little bit longer than we had hoped, but no mention of Prohibition. I saw in a review, you know, I read a bunch of reviews that in preparation after watching the film as well, of course. And there was one that sort of took him to task for not mentioning Prohibition. It seemed to completely miss the point of the film. Prohibition is almost proves the point that he's making here, is that when any type of prohibition, in this case, what we know as prohibition in terms of alcohol, but when any type of prohibition genuinely affects a broad base of the population, then it is immediately, relative to history, overturned. And while you have statistically no more crack use or cocaine use by African Americans, you have far more of them in prison. While you have, I don't know what the numbers are for pot or meth, but I imagine that the disparity in terms of class is dramatic in terms of who ends up in jail. It's a great film, and you can support it by if you're in New York going to see it. Heck, I don't know. Go buy a movie. Go buy a ticket for somebody else too. And you can support the opportunity to hear about films like this by supporting this program. How'd you like that for a segue? You can become a member today at majority.fm. You can support this show in other ways, of course. Buy your Amazon crap through our Amazon link. Give us a good review on iTunes. Donate your account. Buy some merch. Buy some coffee. JustCoffee.coop. We'll have some new sponsors in this month coming up. When we head into the better half of the program, I will be discussing, torture. And then torture at the hands of Paul Ryan speaking. Mitt Romney's, he's getting ready with those zingers, folks. We will talk about that. Paul Krugman on the Grand Bargain Watch. Maybe we'll get to that libertarian paradise in Honduras. I don't think we'll actually get there, but maybe we'll get to talk about it. And, of course, we will...
Mom! 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 Why did you do that to me?
Want to be a part of the program? 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. See you in the better half. Oh, you can IM me at Majority FM, of course, too.